two kinds of dying, then one of each is easy, like the sadness that weds us. There are two ways to be alone. One is filled with sunlight, and the yellowing aspen turn it by alchemy into themselves. And then I'll just read a couple of poems from this book. Probably by now everyone knows what the uncertainty principle is, Heisenberg's principle. I used to have to explain that. But by now, you know, history moves so fast. The best explanation I ever heard of it, you know, it's the idea that the presence of an observer changes what's being observed, whether it's anthropology or particle physics. The best illustration I ever heard of it was Douglas Hofstadter's, which he said it's like dropping a quarter into your couch, and you reach down in there and you try to get that back, but as you push your hand down, it spreads the cushions of the couch, and the quarter just keeps going. And in this case, the couch is infinite. So I was thinking about that, and I was thinking about some things that were going on and that will become clear in the poem. And I was also thinking about those guys, the polar explorers, you know, those guys who went to a lot of effort to reach the North Pole. And you know, if you get sort of close to the North Pole, at a certain point, your compass doesn't work anymore. It just goes around and around. And so you have to start navigating with stars and the sun. And then I was thinking, you know, after all that effort and months and like eating dogs and stuff, you get to the North Pole, and then where's north? You got 360 degrees of south. Was that? Well, that's true. The uncertainty principle. The real is not what happens, but what is about to happen. Whatever you were dying for before. Knowing is just feeling with a sense of direction, and thinking tags after like a string of tin cans, annoying everyone. Something was about to happen. My mother said I'd never make it back in time by the way she looked at me forever. She wasn't thinking. I pledge allegiance to her eyes. Don't envy me. When you reach the North Pole, the idea of North becomes unrealized, free. Which North was true? Which South was home? What is it you are dying for? Only the stars which do not know can tell. Only the stars which do not know can tell. Yeah, I'm not gonna read it. For a couple of these poems that I'm going to read, it will be helpful to know that I was born in 1950. This poem is called Independence Day 1956, A Fairy Tale. I think this house's mouth is full of dirt. Smoke is nothing up its sleeve. I think it could explode. Where I am, in the dirt under the floor, I hear them. They don't know. My mother leaves each room my father enters. Now she is cleaning things that are already clean. My father is in the living room. He's pouring. Rum into a glass, gas into a lamp, kerosene into a can. He pours capped fuses, matches, dynamite sticks into his pockets. He pours rounds into the .45, which he will point skyward and hold next to his ear as if it were telling him things. Where I am, the spider spins. The broken mouse drags a trap through lunar talc of dust. Where the bitch whelps is where I wriggle, on my belly, cowardly, ashamed, to escape the 4th of July. I think the house is very ready. It seems to hover like an exploded view in a repair manual, parts suspended in disbelief, nails pulled back, aimed. My father goes out. My mother whimpers. There'll be no supper. She opens the firebox and stuffs it full of forks. The weather spider. A spider lives in the barometer. It's a white spider, and it was born there. Sometimes it rains from a clear blue sky, or rain falls without touching the ground, or it doesn't rain. Of course, we had weather before the spider, before the barometer, so it isn't that. We have thunder in winter, dry lightning unraveling the tree and the three good horses under it, snow leaving the earth and falling straight up back into the cloud. Anybody got a match? Anybody got a thimble full of blood? After a slim night storm, the spidery likenesses of aspens memorized the north sides of the trees themselves. Wouldn't it be wrong to say the new buds wait, sheathed in ice? Do you think the spider doesn't matter to weather just because it lives in the barometer? The first light seems to like it in these glass branches. The whole morning is given to unilateral disarmament of all the sides. Beneath the glass, the spider's indifference towards us grows immense, indomitable. Anybody got a thimble full of blood? Art class. Let us begin with a simple line, drawn as a child would draw it, to indicate the horizon. More real than the real horizon, which is less than line, which is visible abstraction, a ratio. The line ravishes the page with implications of white earth, white sky. The horizon moves as we move, making us feel central. But the horizon is an empty shell, strange radius whose center is peripheral. As the horizon draws us on, withdrawing, the line draws us in requiring further lines, engendering curves, verticals, diagonals, urging shades, shapes, figures. What should we place, in all good faith, on the horizon? A stone? An empty chair? A submarine? Take your time. Take it easy. The horizon will not stop abstracting us. Well, you remember a couple of years ago when everybody was talking about Christopher Columbus. His day was yesterday, I think. And a couple of years ago, there were people saying, you know, you can't celebrate Columbus because he was bad. And there were other people saying, sure you can, Columbus, he was good. And it went on like that. This poem is called On Exploration. A hawk drops to the treetop like a falling cross. The hay barn is ticking. The universe has everything. That's what I like about it. A single chubby cloud beelines downwind, trying to catch up with the others. Yellow leaves plane across the water, drifting the inlet. The pond is a druzy eye. Details tend to equal each other, making decisions harder. Is polio an endangered species? The universe is mostly empty, that's important. A fractal palindrome of concentric emptinesses. Is there life out there? Are there lawns? Columbus is famous for discovering a place where there were already people killing each other. Nothing missing, nothing new. Let's pick wildflowers. Let's take a meteor shower. Let's live forever, and let's die too. The war that isn't what you think. The little wind I saw curving and lifting the black mare's mane never came this way, though I waited, face tilted, to wind as heliotropic is to sun. We have to keep our disappointment alive. We have to sustain our appall, act surprised that humanity has, again today, failed to evolve away from meanness, that we ourselves have failed in this. Invisible earth, I still can't feel any wind, feel though I hear cottonwood leaves that hung still turn sudden, turn all at once, like small birds in a flight of small birds, turning like one thing instead of many. Turn silver side to the wind when it comes, shiver and moan when it comes. O wind immaculate that lifts the mane, immaculate that turns the silver leaves, that bears away the smoke of sacrifice. The wind when it finds me bears no trace of sage sweet horse smell, no color black, no softness of muzzle of the mare, her mane curving and lifting where she grazes the horizon down to nothing. Jane made an allusion to Greek fragments, so I should read this. It's called Sapphic Suicide Note. Day out, no world, italics mine. There aren't any italics. This poem came out of I've never really written poems on request. I don't intend to really do that, but I got asked to write a poem about a painting, along with a number of other poets, and all the other poets went through this catalog. We're supposed to write a poem about a painting in a certain art collection, and all the smart guys went through and they chose paintings that like had stuff in them, you know. I chose Mark Rothko because I like Rothko, you know, and I didn't really just poem about the stuff in a painting. So this painting, it's called Untitled 1968, and it's a fairly typical Rothko painting if you know his work. It's a red, well, it's many reds, but it is red and color field, and it has just a slightly less red band across the middle of it. Untitled 1968 for Mark Rothko. There's no such thing as an emergency. Betrayal is eventual. The bridge is a river, when you think about it. River of blood, when you think about it. The Lord giveth. Highest echelons of quietude. A Veronica in each sunset. In every blackening bandage in the hospital's unspeakable bins, a Veronica. Someone suffered here. The elevator of blood rose like any other. Why not? Our nets were full of sunset when we hauled them in. The red sail filled and pulled us darkward. Blood in the drum roll blossomed. The Lord giveth. Thou shalt. Change the bandages when they blacken. Don't think about it. Set the red sail and disappear. Slow drip in silence. Don't say a word. Don't say the wine glass on the sill is a sun-dried sangrail. It's a landscape. You just can't bring your body. The bridge is an inward horizon. The bridge has arrived in time for us to cross. I know, because someone or his assistant suffered here. Resurrection update. And then it happened. Amidst cosmic busting and booming, gravity snapped that galactic and pinion. Trees took off like rockets. Cemeteries exploded. The living and the dead flew straight up together. Only up was gone. Up was away. Earth still spun as it stalled and drifted darkward. Sublime. An aspirin and a glass of water. I'm going to try to read a poem that I've never read before. I'm not even sure I like it, but I'll find out. It's called You Know What People Say. Sulky what ifs. Sulky what ifs. They bumblefuck the meta stuff. Diffidence their stock in trade. Cozy hell. Cozy hell. They make a mockery of irony. They hold Special Olympics in wit. What was Shakespeare's blood pressure? lots of luck. Vertical river, cloister of thunder, bleeds the ship's fell sail. God comes in for a landing. He lowers God's landing gear. He raises the holy spoilers, lowers the sacred ailerons. He imagines reality. Tried everything in life? Try living. Sulky what-ifs are dumbstruck, drumsticks. Their spiritual actuality is empirical. What if, uppity angels? What if there really were rules? What if those angels melted in the rain? If reality is illusion, wouldn't it stand to reason that illusions are real? A lot of dumb questions. Impingement of external objects or conditions upon the body palpitate apostasy. The oppressed must free the oppressors to free themselves, see? The soul is euphemism for the body. What does willing mean? Do you sense my sense? Am I fashionable? Objective as an angel? Where'd you get your soul, Kmart? Screaming from a safe place? 9 smocked doctors, 3 unmasked. One has left his face sewn to the pillow. One holds a lace fan like a hand of cards she studies, considering the risks. She is the loveliest doctor. Her doctor father scolds her right there in front of all the other doctors. They are aghast. They kneel and don carnival hats with feathers. I don't think they are really doctors. The trees are real. They are green kachinas. Dark rooms of wind are installed in the house of barbarism. The norm is always incorrect. If what? I'm going to put in this next book, there's going to be a page. I wrote this poem before I wrote The Meadow. It's a little prose poem, and it ended up being page 131 of The Meadow. But I never published it as a poem, and since it was written as one, I thought I'd just go ahead and publish it again. It's called Small Countries. In defense of whatever happens next, the navy of flat-bottomed popcorn clouds steams over like they are floating down a river we're under. To the west, red cliffs, more pasture, the blue medicine bow with stretch-marked snowfields, quartzite faces like sunny bone. I'm worried about Lyle getting back from town with his oxygen, but then I see him through binoculars turn the Studebaker, ant-like, off the county road and up the 4-mile grade, so small down there that I want to imagine his hands on the wheel, still strong, his creased blue jeans and high-top shoes I know he wears to town. He turns off the road on a small knoll about halfway up, stops the truck, facing the mountains. He still looks small against so much space, but I can see his left arm and shoulder and the brim of his hat as he lowers, his brim of his hat lowered as he lights a smoke and looks off toward the mountains, and small countries of light and dark rush across the prairie towards him and over him. This is a kind of a weird poem. It's also an older poem that I didn't put in the last book of poems that I published, and it's kind of stayed around and somehow survived. But I had a problem with it because somewhere years ago, someone told me this wonderful word, and I remembered being told, I think, that it was Swedish or something. I think that's what I assumed it was, and the word is svaha, and I was told that it means the space between the lightning and the thunder, which I thought was great, because we don't have a word for that. And so, you know, years and years later, I'm putting this manuscript, and I start to get nervous about this word, because, you know, maybe you should double-check it. And so I asked a Swedish person that I know. She recognized this word, and she said, no. So that left me knowing what the word meant, just not knowing what language it was in. I was just playing hell with the note, see, at the end of the book. I've seen the word used by Gary Snyder in a completely different context, and I suspected since he used it, it must be Sanskrit. So I went to the Sanskrit dictionary, and indeed I found the word, but it doesn't mean the space between the lightning and the thunder. It means to squander one's inheritance. And there's also a similar word very close to that, svavak, which means excrement of dog. So I just deleted the note, and I don't know what to do now. But every time I give a reading, see, I can explain this, and you know that I meant the space between the... I meant that I thought that there was this word, see? So this is Big Thompson's Faha. Big Thompson Canyon in Colorado is where, I think it was in 1972 or 74, something like that, they had a flash flood and 220 people were killed. Down from the weary, steeply buttressed cirques, over snow-fat stands of evergreens, the river gathers rain into her skirts and hurries it away. Smithereens of broken mountains blush and steam and yawn. There is no word in English for the gap between the look of lightning and its clap. After a moment of deep consideration, permission to resume our lives again. Tomorrow they will pick limp fishermen from limbs of trees that never meant to bear, and oldsters from Dubuque will point to where their cottage went, while unexploded propane bob, nudge, and spin so unashamed in the deep, permissionless consideration that waits for us, birthlight, death roll, taken. In the stunned little interval between winter and spring, like the held gasp of surprise preceding real wonder, I'm a flashlight in daylight. Green stirs low down and shows through dead blonde shocks of grass, and gray aspen flowers dangle above old snowbanks. I go around like a feral saint. The timber hoards its meager crust of snow. I used to walk over the hill to visit my neighbor about now, just because he was still alive after another winter. We'd look out the window at the groggy meadow, not much to say by the end. This year my neighbor is dead, so I walk the hill anyway. There's his dead house, there's his dead fence. The timber hoards its meager crust of snow. I'm a gunny sack of gravel, I'm sudden as a gust of light. This is just the stunned little interval, after another winter, the held gasp of surprise preceding real wonder. This poem, I don't know if I need to say anything about it really. It was kind of a funny story involved with the people who published first. This is also a pretty old poem, who wanted to publish this in a magazine. There's the second line in it is in Shirley's old photographs. And this magazine was really concerned about, you know, getting sued and stuff. So they called me up and they said, you know, who's Shirley? Are they really her photographs? And I had, they're old photographs. They're not photographs she took, they're photographs she collected. So I had to explain this to this woman. She was getting very, very nervous. And so I said, well, you know, why don't you call Shirley? And she said, well, how do I get in touch with her? And I said, well, the easiest way is that, because Shirley lives out in Laramie, and she's, I told this New York City editor, she's the president of the Albany County Cowbells Association, which is, you know, an auxiliary to the Stock Growers Association. And these photographs actually appear in a book that was published by the Albany County Cowbells. It was a book of pictures of one-room schools, and it was called Cowbells Ring School Bells. So I said, go ahead, call her up. You know, it was getting pretty quiet on the other end of the phone. The poem's called Book Learning. She did call her up, by the way, and I think they talked for several hours. There are certain constants in Shirley's old photographs of one-room schools in Albany County, Wyoming. For one thing, the school marms are the only ones whose clothes ever fit. A few depict the pale ragamuffin's horseback, sometimes three or four astride the one quixotic nag that brought them. One shows the four resident scholars perched on the roof of their log alma mater, massive and gloomy as a wooden raft. But most are more formulaic, children mustered against a wall to stand in gap-toothed rows, wildly varying in height and age, pale in their tight or tent-like collages of clothes, their cowboy hats and galoshes, fresh as mushrooms from the log dark where they learned, too dim to photograph, staring straight into the sun of a winter afternoon chosen for its brilliance, trying not to blink for long enough. Indeed, these pictures make Albany County look much than it is. The children look like they are burning up in so much unresisted glare. Never mind the snowdrift loitering on the right, even paler than the squinty grimaces. When they go back in, they'll all go blind a while again, this time in darkness where they could see before. They are learning things whose relevance to the clear light they go home in is only promised. Yeah. This poem's a little longer, but I'll go ahead and try to read it anyway. It's called Western Civilization. You get it? One. That woman still lives at her ranch. You can ask her. Maybe she knows. As near and far as the rest of us can tell, the barn and sheds were built in the Great Depression. Someone had money and a big idea. Far and away the biggest idea I've ever seen. Pat says there must have been 100 men, shepherds and shearers, working there. It's one of those things that not only is, but seems, larger inside than out, like a planetarium or an orange, even with Wyoming around it and real stars flying away. Just stick your head in there. Its dark will make you dizzy. It has an underneath too low to stand in unless you are a sheep. The loft vaults like a dusky church. Two. All that summer, I balanced water, coaxing the desert into pasture, with 8 cubic feet per second for 2,000 acres, horseback, shovel on my shoulder along miles of ditches, stalling here, releasing there, water over the deepening green, keeping it living, herons and cranes, regal and meadows, strings of ducklings frothing the ditch to get away. Three. One day, riding ditches, I saw Clay. He was on the hill against the sky, flapping his arms at me. They were going to bulldoze the corrals at the shearing sheds, intricate maze of gates and pens Clay as a kid had built with his father before they lost their ranch, before Frank died, before the family had to move away. The new owner was raising everything. I guess he had some kind of idea. Clay didn't need any gates, but as Pat said, that's Clay. I met them at the shearing sheds. Pat held a wrecking bar like a steel snake. I just can't stand tearing apart all them guys' dreams, he said, looking shy. Hell is when you know where you are. Four. On the barn roof, a loose piece of tin flaps in the wind like a broken wing. Wyoming whirls in the sun. Up in the loft, a pair of shears, 50 or 60 years forgotten there, floats in noonlight, bearing up some dust. Just a pair of spring steel scissors, 2 knives joined at the hip with smiling edges. An owl the color of things left alone flaps out of the gable door. Hell is when you know where you are. Mazes of pens and gates, dreaming sheep, miles of ditches, dreaming green. Five. No one living knows who built the shearing sheds, unless maybe that woman, and I'm not about to ask her, ever since she tried to stab her husband with a pair of scissors. He was 91 and barely held her off. Later, she claimed she was just trying to cut his heart medication out of his shirt pocket. Dope, she called it. And the old man had to leave the ranch where he didn't last long. They bulldozed the corrals. We got 40 gates. We took them someplace safe. Now the vast, dim barn floats like an ocean liner whose doldrums are meadows spinning into brush. And everywhere you look, Wyoming hurries off. All night, the stars make their escape. In the loft, a pair of shears cuts woolly moonlight. All day, a piece of roofing slaps in the wind. A startled owl flaps out of the gable. Hell is when you are, and it's beautiful. You save the gates for nothing. You balance the water to keep the green from spinning away into the sage, same gray as the wing that just now shaded your eyes. I'm not sure I should read this poem. It's really not PC at all. You want me to read it? It's pretty bad, Dennis. Okay, I'll give it a try. Actually, it's okay because it's all quotes, this poem. I didn't say any of it. The poem is called Rintrah Roars, which refers to one of Blake's crazy emanations. And at least in the poem that I got sort of inspired by, Rintrah is the just wrath of the prophet. And since I'm no prophet, I had to just use prophetic quotes that I heard one week. Giotto, you know, is the Italian medieval painter who liked St. Francis a lot. And I think everything else is pretty clear. Maybe it's too clear. My father-in-law writes from Umbria, where peasants eat songbirds for lunch and pray beneath frescoes by Giotto. Saturday, 30 January, last day of the season wherein big men can kill little birds. Lyndon Johnson, while being escorted by a young Marine who said, "That one over there is your helicopter, sir," replied, placing his arm around the boy, "Son, they're all my helicopters." Sam said, "I might be white bread, but there is one pissed off nigger in my heart." McPherson says he doesn't see anything in the world worth coming back for. He wants to get off the wheel. Says, "I don't want to come back as anything, not even a bumblebee." So I say, "Oh, Jim, you'd make a good bumblebee." But I was thinking, that should be enough for anybody's God. Pruitt said, "Man, I wouldn't fuck her with your dick." It would be trite to describe the clocksmith's house, the way it sounded like bees in there. You can never have enough clocks in your house. This from a man who had thousands in his. I asked, "You probably don't even hear them anymore." He said, "I hear them when they stop." Lyle said, "It's all right to be a fool. It's just not all right to be an old fool." Steve, the banjo, wasn't all they smashed. It was every window. It was everything I had. You don't want to feel the wind blow through your house that way. Another friend said, "I am chained to the earth to pay for the freedom of my eyes." Expecting company. Death is when the outside world wants to get away from itself by going inside of someone. Till the walls cave in, till the roof is gone, I'm floating face up on a sea of adrenaline. A broken window hangs around my neck. I have to make more room in here. I have to get rid of the furniture. I'll read a couple more poems. It's Christmas 1960. Some of my friends were hoping for BB guns. I had it over them. My dad gave me a 30-30. What a great guy. He gave me ammunition, and when I fired it, he always stood behind me to catch me when it always knocked me down. He was getting me ready to kill a deer that fall. He taught me to sit stone still in a rock outcrop at the bottom of a draw. He was going to drive the deer down to me, close enough to kill. Even a child could kill that close. The other thing he taught me was the 20-minute nap, the way you get your sleep in war. We practiced daily. Like somebody threw a rock through the window from the outside and covered the bed with broken glass, that's how I lay next to my father on the bed while he took his 20-minute nap, breathing in through his nose and out through his mouth, and I lay there, light beside him, under orders. It wasn't child abuse. He never touched me. I would have levitated if he'd taught me that. I wasn't napping. I was not daring to move for fear he'd wake. I was paying attention to the aspen wood paneling, the knots like bird's eyes in the sun. Like Ophelia was how I felt, as the raptor's eyes grew faces, wings. My face felt like it was pushing through from the other side of a looking glass. Could I have floated like the dead? I would, but like the living, sank. The birds with eyes, not all of them friendly, swirled over me. I saw a drop of blood at the center of everything. I knew what God was. I knew I was my father's little teddy bear of stone. Postcard. Days are cubes of light that equal each other. Whether anything happens in them or not, no matter what anyone did or didn't do, they are equal. The emptiest are lovely, though one is drawn to the bright-edged shards of days that cracked from disappointment and longing. Some days I go looking for oceans. If I find one, I search the beach for the teeth I left in a glass of water in a motel room in Nebraska. I'm losing the ability to tremble. I find appearances helpful. Some days I go looking for the sky. Thanks.